rabbinic law subsumes the concept of damages under a number of general categories, each of which is given in the schools a shorthand label which refers to the particular law or case in the Torah from which all of the subsequent decisions are elaborated. These categories are shein, the tooth, regel, the foot, keren, horn, bor, a pit, and esh, fire. The concept of shein, of tooth, deals with damages which come from someone consuming that which belongs to another. And the biblical case involves a flock that break down the fence of another man's field and go in there and eat up the fodder. Regel, the foot, involves the rule of trespass and deals with an ox who gets into a neighbor's field and tramples underneath his feet the standing corn. Keren deals with a general concept of physical damage, physical harm. The biblical law concerns an ox which gores another ox, another animal. The concept of bor is that of negligence. It involves a man who digs a pit and fails to make appropriate provision to cover the pit, and so that in the subsequent days an animal stumbles into it and is harmed. The general concept of esh, or fire, deals with damage done to another's property or person not through direct contact. The biblical law reads, when a fire is started and spreads to thorns, so that the stacked, standing, or growing corn is consumed, he who started the fire must make restitution. And when the sages of the rabbinic tradition began to elaborate on this Torah law, they spoke of damages or harm done by being carried by the winds. And the image, of course, is that of a fire which you start, the embers of which are caught up in the winds, and they go and they fall on somebody else's field or on somebody else's roof, and a fire is started, and you are, of course, liable for the damage done by that fire. Now, the human mind, as you well know, is a strange and wondrous instrument. And when I first heard of the events on Three Mile Island, the Susquehanna River down near Harrisburg, my first thought was had to do with survival. What would I ask my family to do? To listen to the reassuring noises coming from the public relations officer of the utility, or to go to the car as quickly as we could and come to visit our family in Cleveland. And I decided that whatever else Cleveland might be, it was safe in comparison to the potential danger at Harrisburg. And then my mind went back to lessons learned long since 30 years ago, having to do with harm caused by being carried by the winds. I thought of radioactivity. I thought of the winds. I thought of the spread of danger, the unseen danger of radioactivity, and the potential harm which could be caused. And I found, surprisingly, as I ran down this old rabbinic concept of damages, that it helped me clear up my mind about our immediate problem. The question when we deal with nuclear energy is a very complicated one. To most of us who are non-scientists, it seems arcane. We lack the knowledge, the conceptual tools to deal with many of the problems. What problems do the events at Three Mile Island create for us? What issues ought we to be mulling over? What issues require the decision of citizens as opposed to the calculations of professionals, of the physical scientists and of the engineers? So permit me to be a malamed for a moment, to talk of rabbinic law. The law of Aish, the law which deals with fire and harm caused by being carried by the winds, separates out what they call the seasonal winds for the unexpected wind. If you build a nuclear plant near Harrisburg and you know that there are going to be some radioactive emissions, you can assume that the day when these emissions occur will not be windless. There's a normal current in the air. When a man builds a fire, he must build it sufficiently far from his neighbor's property line so that in the course of the daily winds, the embers will not be carried across into his neighbor's property. And clearly, the engineers and the scientists who built the Three Mile Island reactor knew that there were winds, that emissions would be carried away from the plant site. Why else had the Nuclear Regulatory Commission ordered the implantation of counting devices that measure radioactivity miles away from the site itself? Obviously, there was a chance that there would be such an emission. The theory on which the rabbinic law is based is that of foresight. You can be held responsible from that which you ought, and under normal conditions, to have foreseen. You can foresee winds. You cannot foresee that a tornado will suddenly come up and throw the roof off your house onto the house of your neighbor. That's beyond the realm of foreseeability. And using this concept of foreseeing, the rabbis made another separation. They said, for instance, that an infant, a retarded person, someone who is senile, cannot be held legally culpable for lacking the ability to foresee the consequences of most of their actions. They don't have this kind of ability. And at the same time, a professional, an expert in the field, is held far more culpable than the amateur, the ordinary citizen, because he has the ability to foresee the consequences of an act far better than those who are not professional in a given area of knowledge. Here again, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the utility would seem to be culpable, liable. For certainly the consequences of nuclear fallout have been well publicized and well known even to us amateur scientists for the last 30 years and more. And there have been all manner of tests and calculations which indicate that though a plant may have a very high degree of safety, there is no such thing as absolute safety. But, before we simply say there is culpability, there is liability, and let it go at that, we must accept into our thought the one defense which rabbinic law allows against damages caused by harm carried by the winds, or many other kinds of harm. And that is, if the agent performs his act under orders of the court. The biblical law is that if a man is ordered by the court to be flogged, the man who carries out that order, the sheriff, the bailiff, who actually does the flogging, cannot be sued by the prisoner for damage, for harm to his body. Because the agent of the court, the bailiff, has simply been carrying out public policy. And a very good case, I'm afraid, can be made out by the utility that in building the nuclear generator, it was simply carrying out American public policy. The design had been approved by various governmental agencies. They had received a license from the government to build the plant. They had received another license to operate the plant. They had received permission, finally, in December of last year, to put the plant into operation. Our government, in the last 20 years or so, has spent literally billions of tax dollars for research and development into nuclear energy. It has been eager for nuclear generators to be built. We've accepted the concept of the necessity of nuclear energy for the well-being of the nation. And under these conditions, barring a form of criminal negligence, the utility can make in Jewish law, in the theory of rabbinic law at least, the case that it was simply acting under orders of the government to carry out public policy. And having come to that point, I came to understand that the issue which we face, we non-scientists and non-engineers, is not the question whether or not there was human error, or the question whether or not this particular design is in some ways unsound, or whether or not the backup coolant systems are properly positioned, or whether or not quality control on the parts used in the plants is of sufficiently high order, or whether or not a particular decision in order to try and damp down the accidents once it has happened was wise or unwise, or whether or not sufficient training had been given to those who are charged with responsibility of managing the plant, or whether or not there was an acting supervisor at the plant who was on the payroll of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. All of these questions and many others of the same type, questions which are being investigated by countless bodies of Congress, are fascinating and important issues, issues which ought to be investigated if we are to continue producing energy through nuclear reaction. But they are essentially practical questions, administrative questions, scientific questions, not our questions. They assume that the answer is, yes, we ought to continue as a matter of public policy to operate the 71 nuclear reactors that are now on the line and to continue and complete building the 100 and more nuclear generators which are in the process of being constructed. They assume that as a matter of public policy, nuclear energy is necessary for the national well-being. And that's the issue. Whether we desire any longer, or should have desired in the first place, if we want to play the argument of hindsight or make the argument, judgment of hindsight, to accept nuclear energy as a part of the whole solution to the energy crisis. That's the issue which every citizen must have an informed opinion about, a judgment about. The other we can safely leave to the scientists. But our question is, what is our position on the generation of energy through nuclear reaction? Why did we get into this field of nuclear energy in the first place? And the answer here, of course, is that there was an energy crisis. Our nation depends upon energy. Production, distribution require energy. Our prosperity requires energy. Our way of life requires energy. Without energy, all that we have would implode. Our standard of living would fall. The kind of political organization we enjoy would diminish. Our freedoms would be rigidly circumscribed. We have been a massive user of energy, not simply because we are energy gluttons, but because the freedoms which we have taken for granted, which we assume to be necessary in modern life, the standard of living which we assume to be possible for moderns, requires massive expenditure of energy. One of the ways in which you can judge how far along a nation has come in emergence into the 20th century is to measure the amount of energy used by each of its citizens. A primitive country uses very little energy. It uses muscle power, horsepower in the literal sense. An advanced country uses great amounts of energy. And the readily available energy resources are rigorously limited. In a matter of a century and a half since the Industrial Revolution, we have come to use up and abuse much of the Earth's most available energy resource. We came as a matter of public policy to use nuclear energy because the gas and oil resource, the original resource, was beginning to run out. Much of what remained was reserved to lands which were organized into a great monopoly, which was extorting from the wealth of the West a very high price for the energy, a price which we were so far willing to pay, but which had already had a pronounced effect on our ability to manage our prosperity and to increase it. Use of gas and oil had a number of deleterious ecological consequences. Any fossil fuel which is burnt extrudes pollutants into the air. And these are harms carried by the winds, which ultimately fall in forms of acetic acid or in other ways. These are pollutants in the air which ultimately cause the smog, which we are in many parts of the country is all too well known. As a matter of public policy, it was decided we ought to free ourselves as much as we can from dependence upon gas and oil as a major fuel for the creation of electricity, because it was so urgently needed for transportation. We had no immediately available other resource in that field. And so we began to move away from gas and oil to other forms of energy. We next came to coal. We came to coal because America has an amazing supply, amazing reservoir of coal deposits, 300-400 years worth. When we come to coal, we come to danger and to death. And it is well to remember in our concerns about nuclear energy that we moved away from the coal solution because of its malign and deleterious consequences. Every year, hundreds of miners are killed or injured in the mines. Every year, thousands of miners come down with black lung disease, which cripples their ability to breathe, limits their health, limits their survival. When we burn a coal, we again extrude the pollutants into the air, and the winds carry the harm hither and yon. Many of you can remember the flats when there was a coat of grime over many of the buildings caused by the emissions from the smokestacks which were burning coal. The burning of coal increases the amount of carcinogenic material in the air, and scientists tell us that the burning of vast amounts of coal was already creating what they called a greenhouse effect. That is, it was so warming up the atmosphere because the ovens were open that there were major climatological changes taking place, and had we continued to burn coal to the degree that we were, the earth would have warmed up, the glaciers would have melted, the water levels would have risen, and major erosion involving hundreds of square miles of land would have taken place wherever there was shoreline. There are all kinds of reasons, which we've quickly forgotten, why we moved away from coal as the basic solution to the creation of electrical power. We came to nuclear energy because we were told by our government, given the situation with gas and oil, given the facts about coal, the nuclear energy represented a readily available source of electrical energy, which was clean, cheap, and safe. This we were promised by the government. It was clean. The chemical reaction which creates the power takes place in a completely shielded vessel. Nothing is emitted into the air as it is with coal or gas and oil, except for the potential of the radioactive emissions, but we were guaranteed that there would be sufficient shields and sufficient footage of concrete to prevent that from taking place. And we were told that this energy was readily available. Many of the resources were in the free world and not in the Mideastern world, and that it would be cheap, could be produced at a penny or two per kilowatt as opposed to much higher costs for the conventional forms of energy, and moreover, that it was safe, that science had the capacity to create plants which were completely safe. Yes, there was the danger, a readily acknowledged danger to life, to genetic survival, to ecology from radioactive emissions. But we were told to remember that we get so many units of radioactivity just from the natural atmosphere, and whatever we received by chance, by pure chance from these generators would be a matter of a minute proportion of what we naturally receive. And we were told that they could construct plants which were so safe that the plants would have a possibility of an accident less than one accident per billion years of online activity. Whether it is a billion years of online activity or a million years of online activity, the Three Mile Island accident took place after only 440 years of generator activity by nuclear energy generators. Unfortunately, most of the premises which we were encouraged to accept by the government and by scientists who supported the government position have proven not to be true. Nuclear energy is not cheap energy. Nuclear energy has proven to be, in fact, more costly than energy produced by coal or by gas and oil, even at the prices of gas and oil today. You have to factor in unexpected costs. They thought that they could produce a nuclear generator for $100 or $200 million of dollars. The nuclear generators which they are now building require an expenditure of $1 billion or $1.5 billion. The government invested literally tens of billions of dollars in research and development, money which must be figured into the cost of producing this power. In order to provide the safeguards required by present standards of safety, the costs of producing energy has risen remarkably. It proved not to be easy. And there proved to be also a number of problems which have not yet been solved, if in fact the safety problem has been solved. The scientists do not know yet how, in fact, to store nuclear active waste after it has been used to the fullest extent that it can be used by a generator. It remains radioactive for thousands of years. It must be shielded and buried in some way, and there are no guarantees that there are shields and forms of burial which may not split or be leached out or in some other way break open during that very long period of time. And it turns out now that after a given number of years, a plant must be mothballed. It itself becomes radioactive. It can no longer be used. And we're not sure how a plant can be put into mothballs in such a way as to guarantee relatively absolute safety to the people who live in the nearby areas and to the land which is adjacent to it. Nuclear energy proved not to be cheap. It proved not to be completely safe. One of the problems for all of us has been that those who made these claims for the safety of the nuclear reactor seem to have overlooked the accidents and the reports of accidents which kept coming in. In the last 4 years alone, not counting the accident which took place 2 weeks ago, 8 major accidents were reported, or rather, not made much of. In March of 1975, there was a fire in the control room at the Browns Ferry nuclear power plant near Athens, Alabama, which forced the shutdown of the one reactor in operation. In September of 1976, one person was killed and 6 were injured after being exposed to poisonous but non-radioactive argon gas at the Donald Cook nuclear power plant in Bridgman, Michigan. In August of 1977, an accident at the Illinois Power Company plant outside of Clinton involved X-ray testing equipment. In September of 1977, about 42,000 pounds of radioactive uranium powder were scattered in a highway near Springfield, Colorado, after a truck carrying the material overturned. In December of 1977, in Waterford, Connecticut, an explosion at the Millstone nuclear power plant left one employee seriously contaminated from radioactive grains of sand, and the plant's 2 reactors had to be shut down. In December of 1977, 4 workers received small doses of radiation while working at a reactor at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Richland, Washington. A month earlier, the Hanford reactor had been shut down temporarily after some radioactive water had been leaked into the Columbia River. In March of 1978, an explosion occurred at the Vermont Yankee power plant in Vernon, Vermont, the second at the plant in 4 months. No injuries or release of radiation were reported. In April of 1978, 2 workers at the Trojan nuclear power plant near Rainier, Oregon, were exposed to high doses of radiation. The government found 6 safety violations and fined the Portland General Electric Company $20,500. Now, that's not a safety record, which gives any of us great confidence. And it's clear that the government and the utilities have not been as careful as in informing the public about the dangers associated with the creation and generation of nuclear power as they have been with the presumed safety of these same generators. Now, they delight to make the case that these accidents were all minor. Very few actual injuries are involved. And they compare the three or four deaths and the fewer three or four or five people who suffered excessive degrees of radiation to the 2,000 some odd people who were killed in Ohio driving on the highways last year. Or they make some other comparison. The danger, of course, is not simply that a few workers at these power plants may be exposed, but there can be a meltdown and an area of many square miles can be absolutely devastated, and the people who live in that area may either die or suffer damage to their bodies, which will not only bring them to an early death, but may affect their children and their grandchildren after them. That's the anxiety, and that's the worry. It's a very real worry. What then? I suspect that if most of us knew then what we know now, we would have encouraged our government 15 years ago not to embark on the massive program for the building of large nuclear energy generators. There were other solutions. There are ways, apparently, to harness the tides and the rivers. We are now beginning to explore more energetically the whole question of development of solar energy. I remember always the delightful picture that I saw someplace of New York during that 1977 blackout. The picture is absolutely black. And when you look to the east side of New York, poorest tenements of New York, you see one or two buildings with their lights in the windows. The people in those buildings were so poor that they had built little windmills on the roof, and there was enough wind those days to turn the windmills to generate enough energy, at least for those apartments. At least on a small scale, in certain areas, there are other ways of developing power. And surely if this great technologically talented nation had invested the billions of dollars and the number of competent scientists into the question and asked different questions of the scientists. Rule out nuclear energy and try something else. Perhaps we would have come to quite other solutions. But we took this route. And there's no point in saying it should have been otherwise. The question is, what now? Should we demand that the government close down the 70 operating plants, which now produce about 13% of our energy? Should we demand that all work on the 100 and some odd plants under construction be abandoned? Can our society withstand the cost of throwing down the drain about $250 billion worth of investment? I would suggest to you that the economic shock of such a decision would be greater than the doubling and tripling of oil prices, which have taken place since the formation of OPEC. You know, one of the things that all of us must recognize is that there are no good options here. That if the various alliances that have been formed to close down Seabrook or to close down some other energy generator are in fact successful, and all of the nuclear energy generating stations in the United States are closed down, we will not have made a major contribution to the health and safety of the nation. We have no alternative at this point of time but to revert to burning of coal. More miners' lives, more black lung disease, more carcinogenic substances thrown out into the air, clearly. And I often wonder as I think over the self-righteousness which has been exhibited on both sides of this issue, Whether on the one side, the side of those who are opposed to all forms of nuclear energy, we are not seeing a little bit what we saw during the Vietnamese War. That in theory they are right, but in reality it is not a black and white issue. In reality, there's a question that they have to face. Everyone who ran off to Canada consigned somebody from the center city to Vietnam. And I keep wondering if the concern by those who have been so concerned about nuclear energy shows some kind of lack of concern for the miner, the people in West Virginia, and for the people who will live near the coal-burning plants. It's a serious question which moral people must face. At the same time, I cannot understand the callous contempt for life and safety involved in a decision by a public utility or licensed by the government and by a regulatory agency which is in the business of overseeing our safety in this area, which allows a plant to come on the line one day before a new year begins because it will get a tax deduction for the entire year. What kind of licensing procedures and what kind of public safety issues are involved here? Unfortunately, the profit motive runs counter to the safety motive. They could build nuclear reactors for $200 million, but we made them build them at $1 billion and more because of the safety issue. One of the problems is that those people who run the public utilities in the United States are not necessarily the best judges, and certainly they ought not to be the self-sufficient judges of what is a matter which involves the public safety. In the last 6 months, I've had enough to do with the management of the Cleveland Electric Aluminum Company to know that I don't want them making the decisions that involve the safety of my family or my own safety or your safety. And certainly the way in which the management of the utility handled itself that first day of the accident makes everyone realize that their primary concern had to do with lawsuits which might arise 6 months later and not primarily with what ought to be done by those who lived in the immediate neighborhood of the plant whose lives were on the line then and there. The question which we face, the public policy question we face, is not one for which there is a moral answer. That's the problem. Ideally, we ought to move away from nuclear energy. The risks are too high. No system can be engineered which precludes all human error, clearly. No system can be engineered where some part is not weaker than the rest of the parts, clearly. There will be accidents. But at the same time, can the country survive without energy? Can we throw an investment of this magnitude out the window, mothball it? Yes, we can. Obviously. But at what cost? What cost to the economy? What cost, therefore, to our way of life and to our freedoms? In one sense, the issue of nuclear energy seems to be taking care of itself. It is my understanding, if the materials that I have been reading are accurate, that there has been that only one new nuclear generating plant has been ordered this past 2 years. The companies are finding that purely on economic grounds, push towards nuclear energy does not make sense to them any longer. And so we seem to be in a position where once the present plants are constructed, that will essentially be it. And given the amount of concern that there's been over the safety issue, it would seem plausible that insofar as human beings can judge, there's a good bit of safety built into these plants. There's a plant that they built in the far reaches of Idaho, which is built for no other purpose than to test out the safety of nuclear energy generators. $500 million. Was invested in a plant which will never produce energy for practical purposes, but only to discover what needs to be done to make the present plants even safer. It's hard to preach prudence. It's much easier to preach on an either or, a black or white background. I wish I could say that all right is in the hands and the side of those who argue against any further use of nuclear energy. Certainly it is clear to me that we ought to call a halt to any further construction, any further planning and construction. That our research and development dollars ought to go into alternative forms of energy. But we need energy. We need electricity. We need light. We need heat. And America, to remain the kind of country that it is, with the freedoms that it has, needs a certain degree of prosperity. And so, what is an acceptable risk? Do I like the fact that we live downwind from the Davis-Bessey plant, and that this plant is constructed on the same model as the plant at Three Mile Island, and that one of the members of the consortium is the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company? No, I do not like that fact. It doesn't add to my sense of security. And at the same time, though the danger might not be as frightening in one sense, I would not like to see another 3 or 4 coal-burning electrical generators built along the lakefront. We've had them. We fought against them. We forced them to be built elsewhere. There's an old rabbinic principle that in the real world, the theories of law are not as important as managing to survive. I'm glad, in one sense, that there has been this concern expressed right along by scientists and others who've known far better than you or I what they were talking about, which has forced a marked upgrading in the safety concerns of the utilities. Clearly, there needs to be much far better supervision by a Nuclear Regulatory Commission and supervision of that commission by our elected officials. I remind you that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission exists because the old Atomic Energy Commission proved to be unworthy of public trust. And we have to make sure that a regulatory commission is not in bed with the utilities it is supposed to supervise. I listened the other night, some of you may also have listened to the testimony before the Senator Kennedy's Committee of the United States Senate on Health Concerns. And the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Agency was testifying, and he spoke with pride of the fact that they have a plan afoot to put a senior representative of the committee on site in each of the plants which are now operating. And one of the senators there, I think it was Senator Kennedy, but maybe when someone else said to him, well, how long has this program been aborting? Why didn't you have somebody at Harrisburg? And the answer is, we've been working on it for 4 years. And there are now 35 men stationed and 35 or more plants where no one is stationed. Well, that's not the protection of the public safety. It took them 3 days to mount a health team to send in to Harrisburg. And that's also not properly supervising the public safety. I hope and pray that the lawmakers will see to it that far more rigid standards are maintained. But at the same time, you and I must learn to accept something I've tried to preach to you in various ways. And as you know, I'm not a messianist. And that is that most of life's problems have no solutions. And all we can do is to make the best of the options that are available to us. There is no simple, clean, and safe way to solve the energy crisis in which our country finds itself embroiled. It worries me a little bit that so many of my friends who are involved in the anti-nuclear energy program, and I'm speaking now of not of the anti-military nuclear energy, but anti-civilian nuclear energy program, feel that there is only one answer, one way. All right is on their side. It isn't. It isn't because we don't have all an option on the other side, which is clean and safe and cheap and which will guarantee the public safety. We don't. We have to make choices between what really exists. And we have to see to it that those who are charged because of their expert knowledge with our safety do the best that they can to protect it. Will there never be a nuclear accident? I don't know. There have been 8 in the last year. There will be others. Is the truth about Harrisburg that there was an accident of major proportions which threatened the public safety, or that there was an accident of major proportions which ended by not threatening all of our lives? These accidents have been serious, but yet they have not led to the ultimate meltdown, the ultimate explosion. Some scientists say that explosion is impossible. Apparently there's been some scientific study in Germany to indicate that. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. But I know this, and I close with this. To live is to risk. And the risks that we must take involve making choices between realistic options. We cannot live, we don't have the luxury any longer of living in a world where there is one clear, right way to go. And there's no question about it. And if we go that way, there'll be no deaths, no explosions, no black lung diseases, no pollutants in the air, clean energy, all the things that we think we can take for granted. We don't live in the best of all possible worlds, you and I. We live in this world. Paradise. I'll see you there. Amen.